Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this Times Dylan function. May I introduce myself? My name is John Berg, and at present I'm president of Trinity College, Oxford. But that is not why I'm here this evening. The reason is that Bernard and I have been lifelong friends. We met here as students after the war, and I can assure you that this lecture hall at that time had a rather different appearance. You are sitting, at least in relative, if not entire and complete, comfort. In those days, we did not. What is more, this lecture hall, where Bernard and I heard great names like Lionel Robbins, Friedrich Hayek, Harold Lasky, this lecture hall was also used by the Students' Union for its regular evenings every Thursday when we engaged in student politics. And I remember one particular evening when the student body had to sit in judgment on Bernard, who had engineered his first major hoax of his life when he had arranged for a non-existent student to be elected to the Student Union Council. Neither of us would then, I think, have dreamt that today I would have the honor and immense pleasure to introduce to you here one of the most talented and greatest, some would say the greatest, journalist of our day. Bernard communicates commandingly and vividly on paper. He shuns communication about himself. The search for keys to his personality is shrouded by secrecy. If you have come today because of your interest not only in his writing, but also his personality, his background, and the formative influences upon him, let me offer you a shortcut. His book entitled Enthusiasms. I'm not here to plug his books, but there you will find at least some clues to how he became what he is. Though, on my advice, I think you may prefer to skip pages 212 to 216 in Enthusiasms, consisting of one sentence. One sentence salivating over meals consumed in France, in Italy, in Holland, in Germany, in Austria, India, and in England. But you will also discover his love of cats and his aversion to spiders, his love of fire and the stars, his enthusiasm for books, pictures, cities, walking, Shakespeare, and music. Always, his thoughts are provoking, his opinions stimulating and infuriating, and his judgments profound and perverse. Only Bernard, writing about music, would claim that the Fledermaus, as a work of genius on a par with Fidelio, Figaro, and Tristan, or that the Barber of Seville and Parsifal are enjoyable for the same reason, the triumph of love. But it was the same Bernard Levin who consistently foretold the collapse of communism, who consistently attacked all foes of freedom from west to east, who consistently was banned from Soviet Russia and South Africa, who consistently fought for the refuseniks and the Chinese citizens of Hong Kong, and who consistently held aloft the torch of liberty. So far, I have omitted one enthusiasm, or drug addiction, utopia. Politicians, lawyers, bankers would describe utopia as a world without Bernard Levin. but he is here, fortunately for us. So, let me introduce a man of principle, a man of wit, humour, Swiftian sarcasm, theatre critic, music lover, Wagner maniac, and the most generous of friends. And let us hear from him about Utopia.
Thank you very much, John, for those very warm and very kind and very generous words. I must tell you first that I feel greatly honored in being asked to give this Dylan lecture, and in particular to give it in this room. For this, as John has made clear, is my alma mater. I was a student at the London School of Economics, as he was, many decades ago. I took my degree here, I learned a good deal, and I made some lifelong friends. And I also had a good deal of fun. One item under that heading I have never forgotten. As I'm sure you know, there are many courses being taught at the same time in any university, and a course is made of many lectures. A course has a title, as it might be Revolutionary Themes in Early 19th Century France. Now, professors and lecturers, like other people, are sometimes ill. And one day, the professor taking a course that I was in could not lecture for a few days. Such occurrences were posted on a special notice board, which gave me the imperishable memory I allude to. There, on the notice board, in large letters, was written, "Professor Lasky regrets that he has been obliged to cancel the Soviet Union." But now to the matter in hand. The word Utopia entered the language as the title of Sir Thomas More's famous book, published in 1516. But the idea is as old as mankind. There are few cultures of which records remain that have not devised, believed in, or dreamt of a perfect world in which all people would live in harmony and satisfaction, free from the troubles of the real world in which all people have always been obliged to live. The idea has been used as a magic mirror in which human beings can see themselves transformed. Troubled by wars, men dream of a world at peace, in want of a land flowing with milk and honey, amid conspicuous luxury of a society in which all are equal. The first stirring of human consciousness would have asked the questions that today are being still asked. How did the world start, and why? What are we doing in it? What should we be doing in it? The first answers to those first questions must have been utopian ones. That is why Utopia must blame itself for the flimsiness of the dreams that have warded off the truth. We can hold two things in our minds at the same time: that there is no utopia, and that we can live as though there is. For utopia did not come into the world on chance. It reflects mankind's various longings and the condition that mankind lives in. Utopia, in the end, means that even though we can never reach perfection, we can strive for it. And as we strive, we imagine perfect worlds, perfect communities, perfect societies, and we long to enter. We can enter, but there is an immense entry fee. It is called disillusion. and only those who are wealthy enough to pay the impost in fool's gold may cross the threshold of certain disappointment and perhaps even never find the way out. But of course the whole story of Utopia is one of starting life anew. What else is the touching story of the Garden of Eden, the perfect utopia, symbolized by the innocent nakedness of Adam and Eve, and destroyed by the fatal flaw that has brought down thousands of attempts over the centuries to build a real utopia on the real earth, the serpent? Thomas More's Utopia is celebrated not just because he named an entire genre. The world he creates is a changed England, but it is a special kind of change. All utopias are didactic in one way or another, or they would be meaningless. More's is simple. True faith, simple living, and contempt for those who worship power and pelf. A realistic agenda. He teaches his countrymen to live like utopians, who are by no means perfect beings, living under a benign rule that is itself by no means perfect. Thomas More would have recognized as truly utopian figures such as Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha and Voltaire's Candide. For Candide and Siddhartha are figures more important than they may seem. They are consciously seeking peace, though neither could guess in what form it would be found in the end. And it could be said that as those two certainly would say, that the whole of humanity is a journey to find that peace. But what might utopia be like? Too often, utopianists ignore that question. There is no need to describe perfection. No need, perhaps, but a clear description must surely be interesting. It must encompass equality, but how far is the equality to go? Shall we all wear the same clothes, if only because a difference might imply a superiority, or even a more costly lifestyle? But that surely is impossible, for money must inevitably be outlawed. Indeed, there is no need for outlawry, for in utopia there is no need of money. Then all the goods available must be goods in common, and indeed we must all have the same share. But do we all see everything through the same eyes? In other words, do we all have the same feeling? Is earthly love not worthy to remain in the utopian precincts? More allows married couples to live in utopia and the unwed to marry there, but premarital intercourse is a serious offence, punished by lifelong enforced celibacy, as is adultery. And at every beginning feast and ending feast, which correspond to the months of the worldly year, wives are obliged to kneel down in front of their husbands, where they must confess their sins of commission and omission and ask for absolution. No such corresponding duty falls to the husbands. Throughout the utopian consciousness, there have been utopianizers who argued that if unreformed human beings could be persuaded or commanded to live in specified numbers, in specified areas, in specified patterns, they would live in perfect harmony, i.e., they would have achieved utopia. The most extreme of these was Charles Fourier, who may be the most extreme of all utopianizers. He had worked out a system of mankind's passion, and by some utopian system decided who would live happily ever after. Fourier claimed that when his utopia was ushered in, the sea would turn to lemonade. Yet his cogent assault on the evils of industrialization, his distrust of the claims of reason, his genuine sorrow for the pain of the world, give him an honored place in the roles of the more tiresome but sincere utopians. To the end, he never ceased to believe that his time and his system would come. It is perhaps the greatest example in all utopianism of the triumph of hope over experience. But the runner-up is surely Robert Owen. Owen was rightly known first for his passionate and remarkably successful assault on the conditions of the Industrial Revolution. And if he had left it at that, he would have gone down in history as one of history's leading benefactors. He was such a figure, and recognized as such, even at the time. But he became a fanatical utopian, repeatedly announcing the imminent second coming of Christ. The interesting qualities Owen had are not the ones that steered him into such folly, nor those which blinded him to the impossibility of what he was trying to do. What sums him up is his genuine and complete bewilderment in the face of reality. He simply could not see why his reconstruction of the world and all who lived in it could not come to pass. No utopian has reached as far as Owen. He achieved much early on. If he had controlled his utopian fervor, he would have achieved very much more. Owen, and the whole utopian universe as well, made the inevitable mistake. The mistake is not that we are, or could we, could be perfect beings. It is that we are, or could be, all the same. But we are not all the same. And the utopians who think that we should be are doomed to disappointment over and over again. A gentle message went out from the Peasants' Revolt by John Ball. Things cannot go well in England, nor ever shall, till everything be made common, and there are neither villeins nor gentlemen, but we shall be united together, and the lords shall be no greater masters than ourselves. What have we deserved that we should be thus enslaved? We are all descended from one father and mother, Adam and Eve. What reason can they give to show that they are greater lords than we, save by making us toil and labour so that they can spend? Alas, he was immediately hanged along with his followers. Utopians today are not hanged, but they are disappointed. Yet still they yearn, as witness the utopia of Jerry Rubin. Jerry Rubin went with the 60s as bread goes with butter. Here was his utopia. There will be no more jails, no courts, and no police. The White House will become a crash pad for anybody without a place to stay in Washington. The world will be one big commune with free food and housing, everything shared. Barbers will go to rehabilitation camps where they will grow their hair long. There will be no more schools or churches, because the entire world will become one church and one school. But on this side of the Atlantic, it was taken more seriously when the modern children's crusade began. In 1968, the annus mirabilis of the young and disaffected, all over the advanced world, the young had a wonderful time seizing academic buildings, smashing windows and cars, demanding the impossible. The students called upon the peoples of their countries to join them and overthrow their rulers. In America, Britain, Germany, and elsewhere, such exhortations were ignored. The French Rising was the most thrilling, but in the end there was no need for force. The police broke a few heads, and the young people a few more windows, and Paris returned to an uneasy reality. Reality is the death knell of utopia. That is why we shun reality. We do so in a vast variety of ways, some of them grand and tempestuous, some quiet and domestic. There is a childish strain in Utopia, but it is not to be jeered at. Indeed, it is in one important sense almost a definition of a perfect world. For what is a perfect world? It is one in which there is no unhappiness, no sorrow, no hate, no ugliness, no poverty, no loss, no envy, no deceit, no folly, no worry, no crime, no disappointment, no disease, no cruelty, no quarrels, no treachery, and no failure. Perhaps above all, no failure. The Republic is naturally taken for Plato's principal statement of the ideal society, and so it is. But for a specific legislative program with means of enforcement, he turned to the laws. An ominous title, and there are many more omens to come. Eugenics, the various orders of slaves, a uniform architecture, education, athletics, marriage, men must wed between the ages of 30 and 35. All these aspects of Platoville are laid down by the grim legislator. There are scores more of such rules for living, until the lineaments of the modern totalitarian state can be clearly seen in its mad detail and awfulness, such as, no poet shall compose anything in contravention of the public standards of law and right, honor and good, nor shall be at liberty to display any composition to any private citizen until he has first submitted it to the appointed censors and the curators of law and obtained their approval. Plato's proposals for the ideal society were not put into effect at Athens, but they festered through the centuries, some 23 centuries, to turn up again and again in a thousand forms. Those forms were in essence one. They lay out the boundaries of freedom and forbid the citizens to cross the lines. Incessantly and repetitively, when rulers who are or aspire to being absolute, their first action is to draw up laws, codes, obediences, salutes, threats, all to be followed scrupulously on pain of frightful punishments. So if Plato's brutal society chills the blood, what shall we say of the way that his beliefs have never dissolved, but have only been used in modern forms? Can words, and words long since dead and buried too, cause such consequences? They can, and they did. That is precisely the mystery. How did an economic system with no serious substance in it so gripped the world that until only a few years ago more than half the world lived under governments which claimed to be Marxist? How indeed did the word enter into practically all the world's languages? Weigh the dust. It is no use Marx protesting that what has stemmed from his theories is the fruits of misunderstanding. He may not have meant it, but he was it. Marxism was the strangest aberration the civilized world has ever seen. And the aberration itself, together with what it led to, must be laid at Utopia's feet. The trouble with Utopia in this context is not that it has feet of clay. It always has had. It is that Utopia, while of course regretting the Marxist consequences, is secretly proud of enlisting so powerful, complete, ruthless, and long-lasting an idea into the Utopian ranks.
What all ideologues and ideological utopians always forget is that the future has not yet happened. And all history demonstrates that before it has happened, guesses at its nature are a waste of time. Call no man happy until he is dead. If there is one aspect of utopia that conveys its message more directly than any of the others, it is the insistence that over the next hill is the solution to the mystery. Or if not the next hill, the next but one, or perhaps the one after, but the infinite number of hills in the utopian landscape can be rendered down into a most magical solution. In Shangri-La, King Utopus reigns. In Shangri-Utopia, the lame walk, the dumb speak, the misfit finds his place. No tears are shed, or only tears of joy. And most significantly, there is the one boon that Western man craves above all others, no aging. Heroes flourish, naturally, in Utopia. Though some of them, Roland and Oliver, for instance, have no utopia to flourish in. Robin Hood is a perfectly utopian figure, spending his time robbing the rich and giving to the poor. He has the inevitable foil in the Sheriff of Nottingham. There is a huge literature of pure giving, starting with the Good Samaritan, in which the utopian theme of material equality can be heard. Many of these are concealed tests. The donor gives with no thought of return or reward, whereupon the beggar turns out to be a saint in disguise, or even Christ himself. In a very different vein, there is Superman, a child's dream of goodness. It should not be ignored or dismissed as unworthy of examination. The figure has the lineaments of the Deus Ex Machina, not least because of his quick changes between Clark Kent and the cloaked figure, whose utopian tasks are invariably in the form of putting down evil and working for good. It should be remembered that the figure began life as a character in a child's comic paper. Surely Don Quixote is the most utopian figure in history, albeit fictional history. His very name has turned into a word. Few have achieved that honor. And a word, moreover, with a profoundly utopian meaning. Quixotic is a word not easy to define exactly, but the sense of it can be felt and understood. But he goes further. What would we have done without the expression tilting at windmills? The sad truth is that Don Quixote is a danger to himself and a greater danger to those who have to look after him. In his inward utopia, a metaphor for madness, he upholds the cause of the impossible, the rejection of the obvious, the refusal to be reasonable, the indispensability of the nuisance, the absolute certainty that it is the world which is upside down, not the madman standing on his head. The truth is that all utopians are mad, not just the crazed Don. For what is madness if it is not crying for the moon? As we took the mad knight's name and turned it into a word, so we have taken another such. From Rabelais, we take Rabelaisian. And with the word, there poured forth the greatest of all of the utopias of enjoyment. Rabelais must have a substantial claim to the title of the first citizen of Utopia. Above the great gate was a mighty inscription, making clear, very clear, the kind of people who would not be welcome, including, among others, hypocrites, bigots, snivellers, Ostrogoths, flagellants, beggars, of course lawyers and judges, office holders, scribes and Pharisees, usurers, gluttons, lechers, swindlers, misers, and anyone with the pox. But those who pass the test can look forward to unalloyed happiness. In all the life of the Abbey of Thelema, there was only one rule, one precept, one guiding line. It was, do what you wish is the whole of the law. The route leads to Periclean Athens, which must surely come closest to what utopians seek. 5th century Athens was, like all human states, imperfect. But nothing in the then world, and indeed nothing in the world for a very long time afterwards, and perhaps not even yet, came closer to a utopian perfection. Solon, Cleisthenes, Pericles, these three men, it can be said, with a substantial oversimplification, not only turned a poor and backward city into one of the most important centres of the Aegean, and in doing so laid down not just a system of laws and civil relations that was a model of the known world, but also built the stage on which the glories of Greece would be displayed, and on which they were displayed to such advantage that the world even today gasps at what Greece created. The very idea of the polis was, in its Athenian form, a masterstroke of the imagination. It was not quite pride, not quite justice, not quite neighbourliness, not quite honour, not quite duty, not quite infrangement. But it was all of those things. And in every one of those aspects, the Athenian, consciously or unconsciously, took part. And from this tiny scrap of land, small enough for a healthy man to walk across in a couple of days, there was given to the world not just the principles of democracy, law, citizenship, public service, in a word, the polis, but an outpouring of genius such as the world had never seen, and in all the centuries that have passed has still not seen. Wonder again how this minuscule nation, which flourished for not much more than 150 years, poured out the fruits of a titanic genius, residing, as it must have been, in the Greek people, in philosophy, medicine, astronomy, architecture, sculpture, drama, poetry, literature, physics, rhetoric, education, sport, mathematics, warfare, ritual, social relations, diplomacy, history, legends, gods, liberty, equality, and fraternity. Of all the problems that irk the utopians, the greatest is the problem of evil. Of course, that problem has existed since mankind began to think about his and the world's meaning. All religions have to face the idea of evil and why we have it. Nor is the question by any means easily answered. It may be unanswerable. Among those who contemplate evil, surely the utopian has the hardest nut to crack. If the world could be perfect, why isn't it? Why have so many plans for utopia not only come to grief, but in coming there, unleashed a vast reservoir of new evil? No wonder that there are extreme utopians who believe that when utopia is achieved, nature herself will take a hand and there will be no more poisonous insects or plants, and indeed no more weeds. And if that is no wonder, it is doubly no wonder that the utopian, seized of the notion that utopia can be brought into being, will stop at nothing to help it in its path. It is all the easier to chart the path, what with modern communications technology. Perhaps the computer will usher in utopia. Possibly, though, the computers will rule the world, including mankind. Thomas Molnar, the author of Utopia, the Perennial Heresy, here steps forward to damn the very idea of a perfect world, saying, "At Utopia's roots, there is defiance of God, pride unlimited, a yearning for enormous power, and the assumption of divine attributes with a view to manipulating and shaping mankind's fate. The utopian is not content with pressing man into a mold of his own manufacture. The utopian wants to deal with one entity so as to simplify his own task of transforming the indomitable human spirit into a slave." Well, utopias flourish and utopias perish. In the very sight of one that is perishing, the progenitors are eagerly hurrying to build a new one, frequently on the ashes of the failure. The utopian propensity, it seems, is so strong in us that no warning, no example, no logic is sufficient to break the golden chain, however many times it is shown to be made entirely of brass. Have our utopians never heard of original sin? The strangeness of the story lies not in the fact that human beings are, and are known to be, imperfect. The mystery is why, when that imperfection is everywhere, do the utopians behave as though it did not exist? Again and again, in the teeth of the evidence, we are told that man is naturally perfect, and only when he is left entirely alone to do what he wishes does he become imperfect. Harmless utopians watching their commune fall to pieces are proper subjects for sympathy. But there are also harmful utopians, and Procrustes knew what he was about. If man perfect has become imperfect, he must be made perfect again, at whatever price and irrespective of his own wishes. Utopia calls, and its voice is heard in the remotest corners of the globe. Even what it is saying is unintelligible. The mere lilt of the siren song is enough to bring the hearers streaming out of their homes and villages like the achievements of the Pied Piper. The Pied Piper, as it happens, is a perfect illustration of utopia. Again and again, amid simple folk and learned, old and young, cynical and romantic, the once burned still do not shun the fire. The mirage of utopia is professed more powerful than the trick it invariably plays. There is a restlessness in mankind which can be found in even the most placid of mortals. Men and women seem to be born with inquisitiveness in them, and it is well known that restlessness leads to a desire to find out. And in no area of this restlessness is the desire for a better life, a better world, greater and more rewarding. Is there a utopian gene in mankind which pulls or pushes us to get on, to prosper, to do better than our parents could? For it is not immediately obvious that we need to get on, and indeed there is pain and effort, and often great disillusion, in the striving that is required. And yet, it could have been otherwise, at least in the dreams of utopians. If civilization is the antithesis of feeling, let us get away from civilization and simply feel. It cannot be difficult. The seasons come round, as they have done for innumerable centuries, and their cycles, signifying completeness, are welcomed. How does utopia end? Foolish question. If it ever ended, it would not be utopia. An exploration of its innumerable forms must demonstrate the depth and strength of the beautiful dream, the dream, that is, of a perfect world, and the longing to live in it. All human beings are imperfect, but in every one of them, however deep it is necessary to plumb, grows the seed of perfection, and the yearning for it. Utopia is widely thought of as a daydream, a palliative for the harsh reality of the wakened world. But that is to make a profound mistake. The utopian vista is, for all its elusiveness, solidly real, and it is no exaggeration to say that we cannot do without it. How could we do without it? Why should we do without it? Answers galore. But let us take just one for a moment. The idea of a golden age, a world in which the utopian promise had come true, rich and full, haunts us all, until we believe most passionately that once it was and will be again. King Arthur, for one, gave a solemn promise that he would return, and the drowned world of Atlantis is as real to many of us as is the next street, and will one day rise from the water, dripping jewels. Not surprising, when the world ends, utopia begins. As the millennium approaches, there will be the same kind of warnings, threats, reproaches, dooms, terrors that filled the world 1,000 years ago. The tenacity of utopia is astounding. Utopia is essential, but it cannot be confined in safe channels, and every now and again it breaks its banks and floods the world. It is part of us and an important part, but it is all too often treated as though it was the whole of us, and that way disillusion lies. Perhaps it is time to put it away forever, though knowing well enough that we cannot do so. For the siren call of utopia has blurred distinctions, mishandled truth, preferred dreams to waking, soothed pain without curing the disease that causes it, believed things that should not be believed, made the world into a beautiful flower, but found out too late that in that flower there is always curled a deadly, poisonous serpent. But let the last word be from A.E. Housman, though a most un-utopian figure. One day, a friend asked Housman to write something in one of his books. Housman obliged with these four lines, which perhaps can sum up the whole history of utopia. Here are the stars, the planets seven, and all their fiery train. Content you with the mimic heaven, and on the earth remain. Thank you.
To have a question and answer session about this miserable tale of woe about humanity. Now, so far we've done without microphones. I don't know if this presented a problem.
Yes.
It has.
I hear what you're saying.
Right.
Let's do it again.
Could you please speak up if you are when you ask questions? And if possible, speak not too fast, because people sitting underneath the balcony here may have some difficulty in hearing what you are going to say. So with this introduction, may I invite questions, please? Please.
Is there any evidence that those afflicted...
Sorry?
Is there any evidence that the afflicted may not have had a fair deal?
Sorry,
Is there any evidence that the afflicted may not have had a fair
deal? Is there any evidence that the afflicted are not getting a fair deal?
I think probably it certainly is not getting a fair deal. But the trouble is that the world is untidy. And it's only the dreams of utopia that make them entire in their own image.
Excuse me, may I just ask, could you hear up there?
No.
Well, is it possible for the microphones then to be switched on, please? Is there a problem,
just
rather?
They are on.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
Next question, please. Please, sir. Yes.
Was Jesus Christ an utopian?
I've steered round that one for quite a long time, and I came to the conclusion that yes, he was the greatest of all.
Yes, sir, please.
Sorry.
You were a student at this institution, as I am now. When you were a student, the word economics, did you ever ask what it meant?
Yes, but I never got an answer. Yes, yes, there is evidence, I say, I agree.
Don't you think utopia would be very boring?
That is the great danger. If everything's perfect and everybody's happy and nobody's poor and nobody's angry and nobody hates anybody, there is a considerable literature, incidentally, in this story about this very question. How should we avoid being bored? Since we haven't got the chance to make up our minds literally, we better not think about it.
Please.
Yeah. Is it possible to ask Mr. Levin, from his research on the subject, does man's imagination from utopia spring more from a frustration at his own individual circumstances or from looking at the world in general?
I think we all do that. We all have look out, even if we're not writing books about utopia, I think we all look on the world in our from our eyes. We can't do anything else. I write about the people who, the utopians who filled the book. But in the end, I am seeing them through my eyes, and they're the only pair of eyes I've got.
Gentleman there. No, sorry, on your left.
Mr. Levin, how can you convince the multitudes, believing, as you do, that the country has been for many years with a death wish and accident prone? How do you know that what happened in Bosnia or in the Spanish Civil War or in Hitler's Germany or in Soviet Russia will not happen in exactly 15 years?
Well, in the literal sense, I can't answer that. Nobody knows what the future will hold. But I think that there is sufficient strength in the democracies to make sure that it doesn't happen. And if 40 years or 30 years or 50 years hence I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
I think you should put it in the Times rather than the Sunday Express.
the problem with the people whose writings you've had a chance to review is that they all wrote before the days of information technology and various other technological developments. I'd like to put it to you that utopias are not merely the creation of states where everybody has to perform to behave as you would like them to behave. Utopia can also be the avoidance of having to live in a state where people don't behave as you would like them to behave. And that removing oneself from certain aspects of society has also been one of the objectives of utopians like the Plymouth Brethren, for example. Now, in modern state, of course, one is self-sufficient with information technology. One needn't work in a particular place. And instead of having what I call table d'hôte utopias, which are the kind you've described, you can, in fact, have an a la carte utopia. And you can only associate with those aspects of society which you actually enjoy associating with. And perhaps that's the way we should go.
Well, that needs a totally utopian world, because it means everybody is fitted into the correctly in the correct place, and nobody's out of it, and that'll be a long time coming.
Could I ask Mr. Levin, reading his column today in the Times, and realizing that he's concentrating in a most amazingly fascinating way on the very prosaic and mundane matters such as clearing up rubbish from the streets. Is his fascination with utopia a type of escapism from the dreariness of this world?
Yes, of course it is. Of course it is. It could be nothing else. That's the tragedy is you have to wake up and from the dream. And there is the world, the imperfect world, as imperfect as it was before, and that produces terrible disillusion, and disillusion is not simply waking up and seeing that the streets are dirty again. It goes into gigantic forms. Look, the two greatest utopians in the history of the world were Hitler and Stalin. And why do I say that? Because they were the two men who wanted to cleanse the world of everything except their belief, and that would be the perfect utopia to them, for them.
Mr. Levin, I thought for a minute in your talk you might be actually going to tell us why we'd been lumbered with evil in the life that we have, but you didn't, and I just wondered if you've got any ideas about that.
Well, that should be directed by a clergyman rather than to me. But it is the greatest crux of the entire story, isn't it? As I said, one of my lines. If the world could be perfect, why isn't it? Well, the answer is, the obvious answer, and I can't give a better one, is that we have choice. And we can choose badly, and we can choose well. And we are left alone to make that choice for ourselves. That's the only way I can see it.
Please, the lady in front there.
Do you think sometimes we have crumbs of hope about utopia? For instance, South Africa.
Well, that's a marvellous thing, because from time to time, some huge ball of wickedness explodes and turns into something decent. And we've seen it happen in my lifetime, never mind other people's lifetimes. It can, though. Of course, it's very difficult to predict it, and it's also, which is the trick that utopia plays, when it has happened, it can go bad. After all, South Africa is balanced on a knife edge even now, is it not? Thank heaven, it looks as though it's going to be okay. But then look what happened to Soviet Russia. I spent about 1 million words, or 2 million, 3 million words on that subject over the years, and I said to myself all the time, it will collapse. Communism in Russia will collapse. And it did. And now look, they'll be having civil war themselves. Disillusion is part of utopia and can never not be.
Gentlemen up in the balcony, please.
Mr. Levin, do you believe that innocence can triumph over evil in any real ways in the world?
Yes, I do believe, and if I didn't believe, I would be a very unhappy man. I know what you mean. There is a great deal of evil in the world, and it very frequently beats down good. But it doesn't always do. And the one thing about good is that it is like the phoenix. It burns itself out and then restores itself, while evil, very frequently, not always, alas, goes limping off.
Gentlemen up there, please.
I think I heard you before say that Jesus Christ was a utopian, is that right?
I wish I hadn't started that.
Just a question, if I heard you right, just a question. Does that mean that Christianity, therefore, is actually, or has turned out to be, an utopic religion rather than a practical one?
Well, yes, but don't forget that a thing can, particularly like a religion, can be both at the same time. Can be have a dream of perfection and know at the same time that they are living in an imperfect society and always will be until they get to heaven or whatever it might be.
Lady up there, please.
Mr. Levin, in your previous books and in your articles, there seemed to be a spirit of hope and uplift and optimism. I'm left with a feeling from this book that that has passed and is fading. And there is a downfall, a threnody. Is this true?
I hope it isn't, but I mean, I'm not the best person to go to for my book. I hope not. I think, obviously, when I was writing this book, or rather finishing it, the world was in a terrible state of chaos and still is, and it's getting worse as far as we can see, but I hope it will get better one day. I don't think there is a genuine pessimistic streak through the book. There is pessimism in the book, and it has to be. But I don't believe, I'd better go and read it again. I don't believe I would think that someone who didn't know me or anything about it and just picked up the book and read it would come out saying that's a pessimistic book. I very much hope not, I must say.
I think there's somebody there, yes, this gentleman.
Bernard, you selected 5th century Athens, in spite of slavery there, as one of the nearest approximations to utopia. Is there any state, modern state, exists today that you might speculate is approaching a utopia? I'm thinking in terms of, say, Denmark, or the Bahamas, Costa Rica, or maybe the Southern Islands.
Could you hear up there?
No.
Well, I mean, do say so if you can't. The question was whether Bernard could think of a state in modern times which might approximate to Plato's Greece, e.g. the Bahamas or Denmark.
Well, I did this in a different form some time ago. I said... I was talking about some countries in which bestial things were going on, and then I said something about a country that didn't have any of these terrors and wickednesses, etc. And then I was challenged by a reader to say, "Well, all right, where is your ideal country?" And then I had the devil's own job, I can tell you, because I kept thinking, "Well, what do you measure?" Peace and harmony and democracy and such like things, and I thought, well, it's going to turn out to be Switzerland. And actually I finally fetched up with Italy, I behaved rather badly at that point. I said one of its charms is it despises its politicians, not because they're wicked, but because they're noisy, and things like that. But I suppose there can't be a perfect world, a perfect country, a perfect place. There are obviously places that are closer and farther. What do you want in it? One, I suppose we all want a good climate, a beautiful climate, and perhaps the sand on the shore and the lazy days. Trouble with that, you see, is the serpent gets in. The serpent always says, and you get frightfully bored. You do. You've got your perfect world, your perfect country, because even the perfect country is not perfect.
Please.
I think on a practical level, the kibbutz system in Israel is pretty well nearly utopian. And it has taken people who have been tortured in their lives, children who have suffered terribly, and yet in that system, they've come out as whole people. So I think there is something in the world to give hope.
Yes, I entirely agree, and I regret to say, when I was writing that book, there are some omissions, because I couldn't put everything in. This, I have to confess, was not an omission. I forgot. I simply forgot the kibbutz. But you're absolutely right, sir.
Madam, please.
Do you think any two people in the world would agree on what a utopia should be?
I should say certainly not. I mean, that one of the good things about the human race is that it's individuality. No two people are really exactly the same, and therefore no two people will agree entirely about what utopia is. They can get close, as we can all get close, but no, I don't think so.
Gentleman on the balcony, please.
Levin, I heard you say that Stalin was a utopian, Hitler was a utopian, and Jesus Christ was a utopian. How do you think some of them could get on without a whole mixture of companies?
Well, there are only two there. There's Christ and the two great dictators. And I should have left Christ out anyway in the first place. But certainly the two murderous dictators were utopians. And take Hitler, for instance. He, in his mad, twisted mind, said to himself, I will murder all the Jews, because Jews are not human beings. They're creatures, and we'll just wipe them out. And he damn nearly did. But also, in very much smaller numbers, of course, when he came to power, he killed homosexuals. He killed cripples, even. Why? Because the only way he could see to have his perfect world is to wipe out, to cleanse everything that was getting in the way. I mean, madness can't go further than that, but it's utopia.
Gentlemen up there.
Mr. Levin, utopia is eternal. Would you agree there could be no room for family or long-term friends?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, we're all finite. We'll all die one day. We can remain friends for all our lives. This fellow here is going to be one of my lifelong friends. He was a lifelong friend. What?
Not forever, literally.
We won't go into that just now. Somebody down here, sir, please.
If man cannot find utopia in this life, would he find it reincarnated as a cat?
Well, if there is reincarnation, I bag a cat. And if I've been wicked, it'll be a dog. No, that is also, of course, reincarnation is one of the most powerful utopian concepts, because it is. Here is a world which is imperfect, and I'm unhappy in it, I'm poor, or something like that. But in the next world, it would be different. That is, of course, the idea of heaven.
A gentleman there, please. You.
Isn't Utopia pure fantasy or mental exercise?
No, it isn't. It is that, but that's only a small part of it. It's something very deeply embedded in the human psyche, and I don't think it could ever come out. And it has those propensities that you point out, but they are only, I think, flecks on the body of utopia.
Yes, please.
I wondered if there was any difference between the concept of utopia in the Oriental philosophies, the Chinese and the Indian, and what you have largely dealt with, the Greek or the European.
Yes, it is interesting that I took a long time over that. The Eastern religions, or the Buddhism, Buddhists don't call them a religion, but the forms that utopia takes are myriad, and it turns into in the East what we wouldn't really at first recognize as utopia, but if you look deeper, I think there is very much in it. After all, the obvious instance is Buddhism, the seeking the utter tranquility. What could be more utopian?
You, sir, with gentleman here, please, with beard.
I would like to say that you cannot conceivably in the real world have a permanent or continuous utopia, but you might have it for short periods. And as a musician, I think musicians often find it.
Yes, you're quite right in saying that it can't be perpetual. It always ends, or it never starts. And indeed, I am a music lover, and I find a great deal of utopian feeling, if you like, within when I'm deeply embedded in music. And I sometimes think that that's why music was invented and given to the world.
Gentlemen, somebody up there, madam, please.
Mr. Levin, I'm tempted to say Sir Bernard, as you say, we can't foretell the future.
did you say Sir Bernard or Saint Bernard?
I think the short answer is no, which is a bit rude, but I tell you, we're all having a nice time here. I hope we are. I am. And if you start on that stuff, everybody arguing and they'll be hitting each other. And let's forget it. Let's forget it.
There was somebody else up there. Yes, sir. I think the question was that utopia is not thinking about it, but the opportunity of imposing it.
Yeah, indeed. And you can see it. You see, we think of it, I think of it, most of us think it's the great wicked people, murderers and dictators and cruel people. It doesn't have to be as dramatic as that. Heaven's sake, in even the family circle, these things exist.
Yes, sir, please.
Yes, two comments. I'd appreciate your reaction. The first has to do with Eric Veblen, Order in History, where Veblen argues that the real problem with the utopian is that he tries to immanentize the eschaton. He tries to take something that is eternal, that rests only with God, he tries to create this here on earth under his own power, and therefore, of course, he corrupts everything. Is it possible that might distinguish Hitler and Stalin on the one hand from Jesus on the other? And the second point on the music consideration, Peter Bergen, in A Rumor of Angels, points out that in the concert, in the great concert, as one took place in Vienna when the Anschluss was about to occur, people actually did touch eternity. And that was the kind of really eschatological experience that differs entirely from the utopia that people were, like Hitler, were trying to create.
Well, there's not answer to that because it wasn't a question, you laid down something that, and you did it for me as well. I thank you very much.
May I assume that when utopia arrives, everybody's voice will be heard? And if so, does that mean that we've arrived early?
Yeah. There is no body of people larger than three that one at least would be late.
Anybody else? Yes, sir, please.
Did God make the world?
I won't be tricked into answering that.
Quickly, another question, please.
Well,
My wife and I had the privilege of meeting with Lord Denning about 3 years ago. With a vested interest, I asked him if he thought that the system would go on. And he said it would go on much the same as usual Christian overtones. Is it your firm hope to achieve utopia that the system will go on?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it clearly.
My wife and I met Lord Denning 3 years ago, and I asked him, with a vested interest as a solicitor, if he thought that the English legal system would go on and on. Is it your hope that the system will go on to achieve utopia? Is that legitimate?
Well, it might be legitimate, but we'll all get to heaven first, I can tell you. I mean, I've spent barrels and barrels of ink denouncing the legal professions. What am I to do now? Be a turncoat? Well, I can always hope that, but it's a wry smile that goes with the hope.
Isn't there a fundamental flaw in the search for utopianism? But it's the way that the world relates to us, the way it should be, whereas true contentment is surely the way we relate to the world, which is another thing entirely.
I think you're entirely right, and that is the people come to grief not understanding that, and it should be better known, as it were. After all, we're all looking for harmony and satisfaction of whatever form it takes in our lives, and the irony of it so often in utopia, it just points to the wrong way. The book I quoted very, very briefly in the lecture by Thomas Molnar, The Perennial Heresy, in the book I quote it much more extensively. It's a very interesting attack upon the whole idea of utopia. It is he's a Christian, obviously, and he argues, I'm shortening it, of course, he argues that utopia is a poison which would, if it was powerful enough, poison the truth in religion. He argues it very well indeed, I must say.
I think inevitably this has to come to a close fairly soon. There's one question here. There's a lady there who wants to ask a question. There is a gentleman there, and that will be the last question up on top. Two more questions on top. There will be five questions. There will be it. So please start.
I was going to ask Bernard Levin if he had any idea what the next form of utopianism to be embraced by Russia would be.
Sorry.
What would the next utopianism to be embraced in Russia? What would that
in
be?
Russia, yeah.
Well, I couldn't even make a guess at this time, and in the mess that they're making, I think, because I'm an optimist in these things, where's that lady who said I was a pessimist? I'm an optimist in these things, and I think that even they will sort themselves out, but it's going to be a long time, and there's going to be a lot of bloodshed, I fear, on the way. That's the only pessimistic bit, I think.
Madam, please.
You mentioned Siddhartha, and I'm informed mostly about that by a beautiful film.
I'm sorry, could you speak into this a little bit more?
Like that?
Yes.
Yes.
You mentioned Siddhartha. And Hermann Hesse has written a beautiful poem about that. And the best English equivalent would be, call no man happy until he is dead. Now, most people would regard that, far from utopia, would regard that as profoundly pessimistic.
Yes, but the point of that, that's a trap. Practically everybody falls into it. First of all, it's the last line of Oedipus Rex, Aedius Tyrannus. Call no man happy until he is dead. But Sophocles was quoting. He was quoting Solon, who said it first. But he didn't mean that only the dead are happy. What he meant was, because after all, we're talking about the end of Oedipus Rex. What he meant was that even if you are happy and loved and rich and proud and happy with your children and your family and everything is going perfectly, up to the last second of your life, it can be snatched away and destroyed. That's what Solon meant when he said, call no man happy until he is dead.
You, sir, please.
Mr. Levin, 20 years ago you wrote in the Times warning us all against inventing butter that could be spread straight from the fridge. Instead, you've got non-dairy, low-fat spread. Now, does it demonstrate that utopianism is largely a question of hindsight?
Yeah, these things come round to haunt you.
Please, lady up there.
Well, thank you.
Now comes no less important a part, the opportunity for you, if you wish, to buy Bernard's book and have it signed by him. And the books are on display outside the hall, as you've probably seen. And if you wish to buy one and ask Bernard to sign it, he will remain here. And if you wouldn't mind coming up, he will then sign the book. Thank you very much.